Okay, ladies and gentlemen, hope you can hear all right at the back. This is now the last stage you have to get through. Anyone yawning will be expelled. I've seen one already. I'm Andrew Lee from the Sustainable Development Commission. We're now going to have a lively panel discussion. I'll very briefly introduce the panel at the moment, and then we're going to also welcome Angela Eagle, formerly Treasury Minister, now DWP, Work and Pensions, who is going to speak. Angela is arriving around about 5 to 5, so we may have to just break the conversation to hear the political view and then regroup after she has had to leave later on. I'm sure you're all absolutely bursting with things to say and questions to ask after all the presentations you've heard. I only joined at lunchtime. I enjoyed the speakers this afternoon. I've heard a little bit about what you discussed this morning. Before I just introduce the panel and ask them to say a few words themselves, and then we get into questions, I just wanted to provide a little reality check, because I suspect this room is fairly heavily populated by people who already believe this agenda, otherwise you wouldn't be here. Today, those of you who get The Guardian will have seen this picture. And this is said, the title on this is Roadhog. I'll read you just what it says here. Jeremy Clarkson called it an absolute animal, a psycho car, an axe murderer. With a taut rear end and the stuff dreams are made of. Has the ability to have petrol heads feeling hot and flustered. And according to the EST, this is the most environmentally unfriendly, highest carbon-emitting car in the world after reviewing 1,300 models of car. Now, I just say that just to remind us that actually maybe not everyone is in quite the same place as we are yet, and we have to be thinking about engaging the whole of society. So have a look at that. A year's driving in the Dodge. It's called the Dodge SRT10 Roadster. Emits the same amount of CO2 as absorbed by 322 mature trees, the equivalent of an acre of oak forest. Okay, there's a little bit of perspective. Now, your panel from this afternoon, you've all got the biogs, so I'm not going to spend a long time introducing, but Neil Whitney is at the far end from the... failed already, you see, I can't see to the end of my table. Madeline Bunting, you already know, and writer and columnist on these issues and chairing the earlier session. Neil Whitney from the Department of Energy and Climate Change, or sorting the world's problems out inside government. Nick Pidgeon from Cardiff University on this side. On the other side, Kirsten Reeves from DEFRA, another department dedicated to saving the world of government, and Rebecca Phillips from the Green Alliance. Now, I'm going to start off by asking each of them to spend just 4 minutes introducing themselves and throwing in some thoughts, ideas, or reflections on what they've heard to get us moving. And then I'm going to take 3 of the written questions that people submitted and ask the people who submitted those questions to ask them to the panel. And then we'll go into free flow after that. Okay, thank you. Rebecca, over to you.
Thanks very much, and thanks for inviting me here today. I'm from Green Alliance, which is one of the few environmental NGOs that's actually here today, and we work on making the environment a key issue in political decision-making. We're just about to start a 3-year programme of work on green living, which is very much focusing on how to encourage politicians to really frame policy to enable people to make green living choices. So obviously this conference is very timely for me. I very much enjoyed the presentations earlier, and I was struck by 2 things in particular. First of all, if behaviour change policy is so important and was seen as one of the key things that Stern said we should focus on, then actually, where are most of the representatives from government? We've got a few here on the panel and a few people here from DEFRA, but actually, if we aren't to deal with behaviour change in the round, even though DEFRA owns sustainable consumption and production, we need all the other government departments to be taking notice and to be thinking about how to achieve this. And that means from DFT, from CLG, from Department of Health. So we need sort of more government at the next kind of conference of this kind. Secondly, also along that line, taking the I will, if you will, frame that the SDC set up, we're a business. They're also not really very representative. My second sort of thought from many of the speakers today is on the opportunity that the recession provides us. Not because it will make people more frugal, although I think it will, because actually, if people are being frugal because of economic reasons, the likelihood is they'll just revert to their other behaviour once the economy picks up. But because it gives us an opportunity to really reevaluate and bring things out in the open, as Shane Fudge proposed in his presentation on the UNFCCC, the external environment within which behaviour change policy is made is far from static, which this recession proves. And knowledge about banking practices, for example, among the general public wasn't that great 12 months ago, nor was our knowledge about MPs' expenses. And I think we have to really take this opportunity as a re-evaluation of people's values, which could start giving politicians the political space they need to look at climate change in a new light. But what I'd really like to focus on in the rest of my 4 minutes is leadership. So while the message of I will if you will, you will really still holds true, it's rather morphed into I will once you have. Politicians want people to make space for their action, and very much what we've been talking about today is how do we make that space, how do we mobilise people. And of course I agree that we need that political space because the action that we need is on such an immense scale. And as an environmental NGO, we're constantly being asked to help provide that, to mobilise the population, to demand action, to get people up on the streets demanding change for the climate. Well, the Green Movement is mobilising, and you will see huge amounts of action on Copenhagen, for example, from youth groups to elderly groups to a very sort of broad range of people. But as Lord Giddens argued so well, climate change is not a green issue. It's actually a human issue, and we need to broaden beyond the green ghetto. So that's why us at Green Alliance and many others are working with civil society as a whole. It's the poor, it's the infirm, it's the elderly, it's the refugees who are going to be hit hardest by climate change, and their representatives need to stand up and be heard. And a growing number of them are doing so. But it's not their leadership or that space that I want to focus on, but it's really government leadership. Politicians, through their actions, can also help to make this space, both through government practices in the government estate and setting a good example, the sort of fourth E in the sustainable development, four E's diamond, but also, as George Lakoff argues, through policy. Policy has two impacts. First of all, materially, by making it easier and perhaps more logical for people to take green decisions, but also cognitively, by sending a message to the electorate on what the government thinks is important. By apologising for action on climate change, by always concentrating on the other benefits that it can bring, we constantly undermine action on climate change is good just for its own sake. Second, as Kate Soper argued, by using proactive public policy, government can give consumers a taste of alternatives, as Ken Livingstone did in the congestion charge, for example. And also by opening up the debate, where are the politicians saying that actually to achieve the 80% reduction that we need by 2020, our lifestyles are going to have to change, and opening up a public debate as to how we might collectively like to respond to that. As Kate Soper also said, honesty could be the key here. The public are not stupid. They're not going to be... they're going to see through things if we don't talk about them in their true colours. And Lord Giddens spoke of a need for a vision, and policymakers need to have a new imaginative vision of where we're going to, as without that, how can the public even begin to know where we're aiming and how their actions need to contribute and what they're even calling for? So I argue that politicians have a role in creating the space, as well as us in civil society and the general public and you as social scientists, and creating that mandate for action. And we have an opportunity coming up with the general election. Have politicians ever asked whether they already have that mandate? And couldn't the manifestos be a perfect place to do so? And why might they want to do it in the 2010 general election, if that's when it will be? Because polling shows there is now a green vote. I think almost 10% say that they would take the environment into consideration in their vote choice. So now could be the perfect opportunity.
Great. Many thanks, Rebecca. A lot of things there. David Miliband, when he was at DEFRA, famously morphed I will if you will into the slightly smug-sounding we have, will you? I don't know whether he still does that in the Foreign Office, but Kirsten, over to you, DEFRA.
Hi, I'm Kirsten Reeves, head of the Sustainable Behaviours Unit in DEFRA. I'm just going to outline a few things, perhaps particularly in terms of where we're moving forward in the Behaviours Unit, but also linking that with some of the things that I've heard today. And I think already there are quite a few similarities with some of the points that Rebecca's covered. The Behaviours Unit is really all about, as all of us really in this room are, trying to work out how we can encourage people to live more sustainably. And primarily for us, as for many others in this room, that's about working out how, by understanding through research, by testing hypotheses, perhaps piloting, and helping to take this forward into new interventions, either inside or outside of government. And as a unit, we work with DEFRA and obviously with DEC as well. For us, what we're focusing on now is really exploring what is sustainable consumption policy, not as a big visioning theoretical piece of work, but in terms of, obviously, with that, but what are the actual interventions, what are the tangible things that could form part of sustainable consumption policy beyond what, obviously, we already do within DEFRA and other government departments. And also looking at what a sustainable lifestyle is, drawing on some of the visioning work that many others, some in the room and obviously as some of the presentations we've heard, have done, but also, as Kate referred to, very much having the tangible alternative. What is it really going to look like for people? And for us, we want to focus on the short term. What will it be in perhaps 2015 or 2020? So that we can use that to actually be able to engage with people and get some understanding, as Rebecca said as well, of what is it that we're aiming towards within a time frame that we know is tangible for people rather than working towards where obviously our long-term targets are for 2050. It will draw on the significant evidence base that we and a number of people in this room have helped to build and review, and it will also draw on our framework for pro-environmental behaviours, and some of the core components within that remain and indeed have been discussed again today. For example, the need for a sustainable lifestyle to be aspirational, for it not to be all about compromise and sacrifice, whilst recognising the changes or adaptations to particular behaviours that are required. The fact that there are going to be different journeys for different people within their different lifestyles, to sort of summarise very simply. And for us, that's helped by our segmentation model, where we've tried to work out how can you engage a mainstream audience, not just even those that are most environmentally engaged, but also not those that are necessarily completely opposed. For us, we're looking at that potential where it really is the vast majority of people, probably 60, 70% of the population, who currently recycle, don't do much else, and don't have particularly strong environmental views. That doesn't mean that we are ignoring those that are already doing much more, because we believe there's still potential to work out how we can engage with them to do still more. Government leading by example, something that Rebecca has mentioned, and business too, remains a constant theme. And indeed, we know from very, very recent research that it is a prerequisite for people, that without that, people are less willing to act, or many people are less willing to act. It doesn't necessarily become a direct motivation, but it is part of the basis from which we perhaps have the ability to ask people to do things. We still need to know what behaviours are within a sustainable lifestyle, and we will be reviewing our own understanding of that in terms of our sets of behaviours and goals. We still have a significant research programme, but for us the focus is shifting slightly into more action-based research and piloting, because we know that we need to find a way of taking the magnificent and amazing amount of research and evidence that there is and being able to translate that into something that we can actually see as tangible interventions within government. And to do that, we have to have that middle phase of either having the evidence through action-based research as an evaluation component or through piloting to be able to make that convincing case. The summer strategy that DEC are leading on will, of course, explore much more the actions that are be taken in line by government to achieve the 80% targets by 2050, as well as setting out shorter-term targets, and perhaps, and I think Neil will probably reference that. For me, apart from, I suppose, hearing today some of the links still around what is this lifestyle going to be like, how can we make it aspirational, and the need for government leadership and leadership, in fact, by others, I found the thrifty and the frugality and green part very interesting in terms of it relating to some recent research that we, in fact, have been doing with Resolve, but also because it's a constant ask for us with Indefra in terms of how can we optimise this? Is there something to optimise? What can we work with? And I think the other part of that is almost that whilst we're all hoping that the economic recession will not last that long, that does mean that if we do want to work with anything, we have to decide what it is. It's a very basic point, but it's what is there that we can do to engage with people around alternative purchasing, more sustainable purchasing at this time. And the other aspect of community engagement from this morning's session, and perhaps for me that highlighted some of the challenges for DEFRA and for others as funders in terms of understanding and recognising the potential of community engagement as part of delivering behaviour change on a societal level, using behaviour change obviously in a way that you never would talking to people normally, but how do we see the evidence of that? How can we actually see what behaviour changes, what long-term change has been secured by such action? And also, how do we have to understand who is actually participating? Does it go beyond an activist or a very committed green audience? And I think those are some of the tensions in terms of how we actually move forward and having a more active, supportive role for community engagement.
Great. Thank you very much, Kirsten. And it's certainly true that DEFRA does now have a disturbingly large amount of evidence around behaviour change, which deserves to be more used by other parts of government, I think. And I know you're working hard on that at the moment. Nick, can you give us your view from an academic perspective?
Thank you. Is this okay?
Yeah.
Well, I should say thank you very much for the opportunity to come and talk and be part of the panel. I have a professor of applied psychology or environmental psychology at Cardiff University, and I currently hold an ESRC fellowship to look at public attitudes to climate change, and in particular in relation to, I see the launch of the UK SIP scenarios, I think this afternoon, the increasing uncertainty discourse in climate science communication, which raises a paradox, I think, for the communicators out there, because at the moment we've realised climate change as an anthropogenic phenomenon is certain, we are having to talk about some of the impacts in uncertainty terms. And that raises all sorts of questions for how what we go out and talk about as a community will be interpreted by people out there in the future. Now, I wanted to mention briefly Professor Mike Hume, who was here but has gone, and he wrote a rather interesting book which has just been published called Why We Disagree About Climate Change. I would commend it to everybody, and his major thesis is that the problems we see and some of the solutions we advocate around climate change are often, whether explicitly, maybe often implicitly, coloured by our ideological position and our social location. And I think that's just a comment that I would just leave there hanging in the air. It's not in any sense a criticism of any of the speakers, but thinking through a number of things we've seen today, one wants to be very careful about where somebody's talking about a normative question and where there really is scientific and other evidence underlying what's being said. And I would kind of back up the call from DEFRA to good science and good evidence is very, very important. I'd like to mention a paradox which has kind of been here and for a while, but Lord Giddens' talk kind of brought it home to me, that those of us who do work on attitudes towards climate change find the following, that people are concerned about it, quite highly concerned, actually, if you ask about it on its own. But as soon as you ask about the economy or their partner or what other things, it goes lower down the list. So embedded with a list of other life concerns, it's not the highest thing. And that's kind of a worry for those of us in this community, but it's there. People say it's a distant issue. It won't necessarily affect them. It'll affect others or people in other countries or their grandchildren or way down the line. And there's also a failure to link the causes in terms of individual behaviour and other causes with the consequences. People often see the consequences but don't link them to causes. But the really interesting question, if you ask, well, who's primarily responsible for dealing with climate change, you get a very simple response. Well, it's the international community and governments, and way down the list, myself and families. And that's kind of a puzzle. But when you ask in focus groups why is that the case, people say, well, quite rightly, it's too big a problem. I mean, this is really scary stuff. There are free rider nations out there. It's got to be international agreements. Governments have to take a lead. Now, that's an interesting story for government, because 4 years ago, I sat on an interesting little inquiry for the all-party parliamentary group on climate change, looking into the potential for cross-party consensus on climate change. One of the reasons that that little inquiry had been motivated and went ahead was there was a growing realisation in Parliament that governments are too timid. And I've got two government representatives here, so you can kind of come back on me on this one. And it's all to do with the electoral cycle, that there's a grave difficulty that given that this grave threat we have and the need to really be tough, and we know that the targets we're faced with are exceptionally tough, will governments, given the electoral cycle, take the responsibility? And what we've seen so far, of course, is with the individualisation of decision-making and consumer choice with the market model, there's an attempt in lifestyle change, individual behaviour, or this discourse to say, well, we locate the solution in the individual and the consumer. So the responsibility goes back down to the individual. And we've got a complete gridlock here, that one group thinks the other group are responsible for it, and the other group thinks the first group are responsible for it. And how we break out of that, I think coming back to this issue of empirical evidence, is something that social science in particular can help us with. So I leave you with that thought. I'll say one further thing and then stop. But a reflection this morning, I was sitting, before I went to psychology at Cardiff, I was in the largest environmental science interdisciplinary school in the country at UEA. And there, nobody batted an eyelid if a volcanologist suddenly went off and worked on a problem with an ecologist, let's say. But I noted some nervous laughter when we were talking about, well, do we change the individual or do we change social relations amongst the psychologists and sociologists when it was suggested they work together. Now, I really would like to exhort those of you, and I know Resolve is a good example of this attempt to bring psychology and sociology together, that we will not address the climate change challenge properly without proper interdisciplinary thinking and work around the issue.
Great, thank you very much. I'm going to keep moving along for the panel because I know people will want to ask questions. Neil.
I will try and keep this short. Can you hear me? Good. My name's Neil Whitney. I'm in the Department for Energy and Climate Change, and I work in a directorate called National Climate Change and Consumer Support. So the name of the directorate itself includes a recognition that we need to do more to talk to both consumers and individuals as householders. In particular, I look at local energy generation, that's community and microgeneration, and issues around heating supply. I think I'd start by saying that in some ways we have now, in the UK at least, some space to be able to have some of the political discussions that we talked about earlier. The setting of carbon budgets out to 2022 now means that the level and scope of the problem is recognised. It's now more of a discussion about, well, how are we going to get there? Who's going to do it? At what timescale? So there is now political space for these discussions. Kirsten referred earlier to a summer strategy. The fact that it's called, for officials at least, I don't know if it'll actually be called this in the end, a summer strategy, is a recognition that actually we've had an awful lot of intense dialogue with an awful lot of stakeholders on a very broad number of questions. At the moment, what stakeholders are telling us is that, if anything, they've got dialogue fatigue. We've put out consultations on renewable energy, carbon budgets, heat and energy saving strategy. There's been an awful lot of new thinking going on out there, and a lot of engagement, a lot of discussion about what it is that I suppose government should be doing, and also how we can best support all stakeholders, all parts of the market, if you like, to help us with this. So the summer strategy, for example, does look at, well, what's the best way to talk to householders, particularly with those looking to perhaps to make their houses more energy efficient? What's the best way to help them? We've already announced proposals, for example, on feed-in towers for microgeneration as perhaps a more consumer-friendly way of getting more people to encourage them to take microgeneration. And we've also had a programme called Big Energy Shift, whereby we went out into several communities, talked them through some new technologies, got their views on what they'd be prepared and what they wouldn't do, and then said, OK, well, what would you be prepared to do? What do you think it's for others to do? Who would you trust to help you with this? I think there's still more opportunities to be able to help shape the way the UK responds to meeting the targets that are out there. I think the key thing for me for today is that I've heard an awful lot of very inspiring visions, a lot of things that make me feel very proud that there are people out there thinking in this way, when with very strong ideas about what they'd like the world to be like. I then have to go away and say, okay, well, given the scale of the problem and given the timescales, what's the plausibility of the pathways to getting to that place? Who are the key actors that would actually make that happen? Are they likely to behave in this way that would get you to this goal? And is it likely that a sufficient number of people would behave in that way to get there? I think we've had two quite broad models about how you might get there. One's a new style of international politics, perhaps, based around a language which with shared goals and shared long-term political behaviours. And the other one's more of a bottom-up series of perhaps social enterprises redefining what it is to have a sustainable lifestyle in these days. I don't think they necessarily have to be mutually exclusive, but I'd be very interested to see how those two models might work together.
Great. Many thanks, Neil. Now, Madeline, you get your chance, having had to chair, to say what you think.
I'm not sure I'm going to present any kind of conclusions here, because I think I feel that there's a whole number of questions that are going on in my head at the moment, none of which have any answers. So all I'm going to do is just explain some of them. I think being in the media, you get exposed to a lot of different stories, and it's the kind of competition in those stories, which story is the most convincing, what are the preoccupations. What I found very interesting in the last session was this sort of question of how can we make a low-carbon future seductive. And I think this is very much a kind of key concern of the Green Party. They are, you know, as Caroline Lucas explained very clearly in The Guardian very recently, and again to me, we've got to get past the idea this is caves and candles. Can we present a positive image of what that low-carbon future looks like? I have to say that out of all of the sort of stories that I get to hear about, the one that I've found comes the closest to trying to describe something of that seductive low-carbon future was the kind of ideas and thinking coming out of the transition movement. And I think it's partly the way this movement has been structured, it's partly the language, it's processes. There's a number of, I think, very, very kind of clever characteristics. Clever is perhaps not the right word, inspirational aspects of the movement, which has the potential to make it a really large-scale social movement. And it seems to me that that kind of social movement is a crucial part of the puzzle, and I totally accept the points already made on the panel that there's this awful process going on at the moment where the politicians say, you create the mass movement, and people in civil society saying, well, we can't create the mass movement, you give the leadership. And the media gets caught right in the middle of that because both sides are telling us that, you know, we play a key role in both of those kind of demands, if you like. So I think we need to look very kind of carefully at how the transition movement is trying to tackle several different issues at the same time. It's trying to tackle the environmental issue, a consciousness-raising campaign, and a social recession. There's been a lot of language in another part of the political debate about how social breakdown and communities don't know each other, they're no longer functioning, and how do you knit that social debate with the environmental one, because as any good environmentalist will tell you, that completely integrated, that the quality of community engagement will be a key characteristic of any kind of environmental movement at a local level, which is where, of course, is one of the places it has to happen. And that, and what I think is also very interesting in the transitional movement is how it has a rhetoric of, well, perhaps not quite hedonism, but definitely heading into the territory that Kate was talking about something that's very appealing and attractive. What they talk about is a kind of creativity of everybody, the idea that you need to reskill, that there are so many skills we've lost over the last 50 years, how we grow things, how we repair things, how we make things. The idea that we've lived in a very sort of mediated culture which has made us very passive and which therefore has led to this extraordinarily distorted understanding of our own agency. I can have everything, I can do anything, be anything, it's all too big a problem, I can't do anything. Now, those are the kind of polar extremes which I think end up crippling us with any understanding of what agency really means. We swing violently from one to the other in a very confused and ultimately very crippling way. But the language of hedonism does trouble me, because I think that absolutely unavoidable, and I think we have to be so honest here, is that, you know, one of the biggest problems is entitlement. And I think there's been a culture whereby entitlement was written into every aspect of it. I can, you know, fly to the Caribbean because I've got the cash. I am entitled to put that much carbon into the air. And I think that hedonism has been so predicated on entitlement, I am worth it, that I think dismantling those understandings of hedonism are crucial. And what Kate's talking about is getting beyond that to a reimagining of hedonism. But it's a big jump over, I think, a very big problem. I was very interested when Defra said it's not about sacrifice. It immediately chimed with a wonderful essay, which I would point you to, by Zygmunt Bauman, who is one of my great inspirations, in a book that the Joseph Rowntree Foundation have just brought out, where he just points out that sacrifice has no purchase on our culture, none whatsoever. And you could probably argue historically that that is unprecedented of any human culture. There's always has been an understanding of sacrifice, its role, its place, how it works, where it works. And I think perhaps we need to put that word back into the language, renunciation, because actually these are part of the less is more. Now, you hear people saying less is more in the environmental movement, but they're still very shy and nervous about renunciation and sacrifice. But it seems to me that when Kate talks about the need for a moral renaissance, and Peter talked about the need for a mass epiphany, they're conjuring up absolutely fascinating questions about this sort of moral reawakening. And that, in the end, will inevitably involve questions around sacrifice and renunciation, and the interesting religious understanding of sacrifice, which it is that through sacrifice you come to greater understandings of freedom and love, etc., etc. I mean, there's a religious understanding of sacrifice which ultimately could be quite helpful here, and which I think Kate actually in many ways is talking about in some aspects of her paper. But as a historian, inevitably, I always come at everything, you know, and think about it, what's the historical precedence. I really think it would be very interesting, if we have any historians in the room, to hear from them. When have we, in Western society, had, you know, in the last 250 years, say, a dramatic moral renaissance? What does it look like? How did it happen? Did it rely on psychological insights, which I find the environmental movement is increasingly heavily weighing on? Surely psychology can help us out here, seems to be the environmental argument. And the only example I could think of historically was something around, you know, the Salvation Army in the 1900s, 100 years ago. They talked precisely about moral renaissance. They saw the problems of, you know, urban Britain as all to do with a mass epiphany. And I think that might be quite an interesting example to think. Are there any aspects about that organisation that give us inklings about how certain types of mass movements can develop? I was very struck, though, by what Peter was talking about, given that I'm on this moral territory, about it seemed to me that he presented very quickly, because he didn't have much time, a fairly depressing analysis of how Christianity and the religious ethical traditions of the West have played a big part in getting us into the current mess, the way they've prioritised the quest for eternal life, to summarise it very quickly. And so it means that the challenge here in terms of moral renaissance is enormous. We have to sort of almost start from scratch. It so requires a different type of morality than anything that we can sort of call from our recent past. You know, I'm kind of wondering whether one has a sort of major ethical breakthrough, which, after all, human nature has done before. And very interestingly, if you ask historians of religion like Karen Armstrong, they will point to profound ethical breakthroughs in different civilizations at about the same historical period. And I just want to finally end up in a very different place. Those sort of moral arguments are one side of the equation, but at The Guardian yesterday, at our morning conference, we had a chief executive of one of the major power companies in. And this conversation about moral renaissance would have been, of course, completely foreign to him. What he was proposing was altogether different version of a low-carbon society, in which the first thing he wanted to talk about was carbon capture, and the second thing he wanted to talk about was nuclear power. When at one point I said to him, can you envisage any kind of low-carbon society which acknowledges that growth in GDP in Western industrial nations is not possible, he said, arguable, and then quickly segued very neatly into how China and India, if they're to tackle poverty, have clearly got to grow economically. He didn't want to answer that question at all, nor does any other politician want to answer it. And it seems to me that there are completely competing narratives about what the low-carbon future looks like. There's the political and the power companies who are sort of, you know, a little bit of kind of behavioural change around the edges, but mainly it's business as usual. And then there's this conversation that we're having here. And how those two connect, it seems to me, is very problematic. They seem to me to be on absolute parallel tracks. My fear is that the political and the sort of corporate buy-in to this conversation is negligible.
Madeline, thank you very much. You've had a huge amount of insight from the panel, I think. I'm going to ask three people who submitted questions to ask their questions to start really getting this debate going. The first person is Horace Herring from Open University. Are you here? Good. Can you remember your question? Because I've got it written down.
Hi. I was struck by an article Lord Giddens wrote in the Times a few weeks ago about, he said, the most essential thing was that we get away from catastrophist views of climate change and put forward a more positive vision. And the panel's mentioned this. So my question is, how do we communicate a positive vision of a low-carbon future to the public? Firstly, what is it? In terms of what would life look like? What would we see in the year 2050 as we walk down the street here? Would it be any different, or would we see solar panels, windmills? So, and secondly, how would you communicate this vision to the public? What sort of media would you use? Do you want sort of science fiction novels, TV programmes, TV soap opera on life in a low-carbon society.
So what is it and how?
So what is it?
Okay, well, we were getting into that territory, of course, on the panel itself. So I'm going to go back to Rebecca, though, because green organisations, and I spent most of my career in one, do stand accused of being the doom and gloom merchant sometimes, but are very aware of this problem. So I wonder what her thoughts are.
Firstly, we're one of those green organisations that never actually communicate to the public, so I'm not an expert in this
answer.
Field.
Yeah.
But I would say, first of all, government shouldn't shy away from actually saying we are going to have big choices, and some of those choices are going to be difficult. So actually, as well as communicating a sort of a glorious vision of the future, actually the way to get there might require some pain on the way. Secondly, what is it? Well, I'd like to know that myself, actually, and I'm quite looking forward to seeing what Kirsten is producing with regards to the government's vision of what that's going to be.
Okay, fine. We'll give Kirsten a minute to think about that. Can we ask Nick? Because I see him making lots of notes, and he's written catastrophist.
Thank you, yes. Well, I'll just make one brief comment. I mean, I think there is a lot of merit in the argument that some of the not reporting, it's come from the green groups as well, some of the discourse about climate change that is circulating is too disempowering. What we know, of course, from literature on health behaviour is that if you just try to scare people, they don't change at all. They just kind of blank off and go away, most people. So I think catastrophist imagery and discourse is okay as long as you're putting steps in place that people can do that are practical and that help with the problem. That's how the health behaviour change people have attempted to actually address this one. But I think there's a range of issues about how we communicate. You have to use trusted parties. That doesn't necessarily mean government all the time. And that's one of the powers of one of the big advantages of kind of local initiatives like Transitions, some of the many, many grassroots organisations and community initiatives that are springing up. So I think that's one of the routes. The problem is that those are often small routes, and you then do have to come to this much more mass campaign type work. And I think that has to be very, very carefully planned. That's all I will say in relation to what you say and who you're saying it to, because you've got multiple publics out there as well.
Madeline, I can't see you at the end. Yes, I can see you now. Sacrifice and renunciation you talked about, but how do you frame this positively?
Well, one person put it to me quite interestingly 2 days ago. They said, what we're really talking about is the 1950s with the internet. Now, that sort of slightly stumped me, because, of course, I don't remember much about the 1950s, and nor do many people in the room, but I presume it means no cars. This is you know, one of the great things about Transition. It's like, please ask the people that remember things like that. Maybe you'd like to say a bit of what was in the 1950s. But yeah. Yeah, I mean, I look to my mother and the way she lived her life. She grew all her vegetables, still does, grows all her own vegetables, makes all her own clothes, always did, brought us all up to do that. You know, is it so bad? No. And in terms of communication, I think that one of the reasons why I'm interested in Transition is because I think it puts personal relationship back into politics, and I think that's, you know, absolutely vital, and that's about the discrediting of our political system, you know, that basically we've managerialized and professionalized politics, and it's an empty shell, that actually in many ways politics, conventional mainstream politics, is not going to deliver effective action on this. I feel that it's so hollowed out, and the thing about personal relationship is that's where you really radically change your mind. That's where you gain confidence to do quite dramatic things. And it seems to me that process whereby you turn up to meetings is always ultimately about personal relationship. I don't want to let so-and-so down, so I'm going to go to the meeting. I'm going to turn out on the demo because I don't want to let these and these people down. And it's how you build up those kinds of networks of loyalty and encouragement and support that I think are really crucial to the communication.
Kirsten, anything on the evidence side of this? Or anything else, in fact? You were going to say something different.
I think in terms of what is it, that is where we're starting. I mean, we're starting and we will pull together what there is out there in terms of the visioning work, but also trying to fill that gap between having an idea of the sorts of things we would like people to do, but what is linked with that? What are the products or services that impact on how people do those? In terms of how you can try and communicate it, years ago, John Grant, when he was at St. Luke's, sort of said what we need are sort of more alternative ways of doing things, really for different reasons. So his example was eBay and how successful that had been in terms of getting people to do things in a different way, some of which have been better for the environment, but with that not being its prime purpose. Secondhand versus vintage, durability, lifespan of products is definitely an area that we in DEFRA are sort of in sustainable consumption product side much more interested in trying to work out how we build that into products so that again it's not so much left to the consumer or the person to choose, and of course the famous choice editing, how we can lever that more. In terms of how you communicate it and what sort of media, very quickly, I mean, I think it's what we know, that it has to be everything at every level. And mass communications is certainly not enough. It's certainly something that we believe we have a role to do through our Act on CO2 campaign. But alongside that, we have to have the policy in terms of grant support legislation, but we also have the community engagement activity and programmes such as the Greener Living Fund, which is supporting third sector organisations to deliver, where it's delivering tried and tested approaches, but at a regional or national level. So trying to sort of, I suppose, contribute at different layers where DEFRA perhaps feels it can, whilst knowing, of course, we are just one part of trying to transform this country through all these levels. So the media will be everything and anything, but it's probably not, I would say personally, about using channels for the sake of it. I won't give examples, but it is about how we also encourage others, as in the trusted intermediaries or the supermarkets or the retailers, to use the networks that they have as well.
I'm going to move on and ask Sarah Darby. Are you still here? The Environmental Change Institute? Absolutely. 2 out of 2 so far.
Thank you. It's a pretty loaded question. it was...
I wondered what you think of the proposition that the Copenhagen conference in December is the noisy, disruptive, attention-seeking toddler that is taking our minds off more quieter and perhaps more productive siblings, for example, the triplets in the family, the triple bottom line.
Okay, thanks. Well, I'm going to hand to Neil first, because I know that DEC has a team splendidly called The Road to Copenhagen. So if he's going to defend that.
They do indeed. I should just say that I do national climate change and not international climate change. Which doesn't
no, you do both now. I do both because you're here.
What I would say about my colleagues is that actually the work that goes on in engaging with other countries on climate change towards processes where you perhaps focus on an end like Copenhagen because of the symbolism it provides as well as the route map it provides, is that you actually get an awful lot of ideas from the process itself. And though the ideas that we develop domestically, for example, on the viability of cap and trade systems within the UK led to what happened in the EU emissions trading scheme, is possibly a model for the world. And similarly, there'll be other countries coming up with their own solutions to Copenhagen where we may be able to learn some of the things from it. So I wouldn't... I think it is a noisy toddler to the extent that everyone focuses on this as the end of a process. But I think there's also been an awful lot of value in discussions that have led up to that one conference as well.
And is it just also a distraction, letting government off the hook here, Neil? You know, you can always point to an international process, and if the others would just get their act together, then we could too.
So which bit's the distraction? The conference itself or the process getting to it?
Does it distract from the need for more urgent and immediate action in the UK? Because we can always use the argument that others have to do it and we can't act until they do.
So far, it just hasn't been the case. If anything, it's been the UK leading beforehand because it gives us, in some cases, more moral authority to be able to take to these conferences. There does come a point, though, at which we recognise that the activities of the UK alone are not going to be anywhere near sufficient to be able to tackle climate change.
Who else wants to come in on this one? Rebecca.
I mean, I and most of the Green groups think it would be an absolute tragedy if the talks in Copenhagen failed. I don't see them as a noisy toddler at all, but more as a flagship for action on climate change. And it's, as Neil said, a really important symbol. And if these talks can't work, if the countries can't find some compromise which really shows the urgency of climate change, then I think you'll only end up having much less action on a national level as a result. So I don't think it's the noisy toddler. I think it will actually lead to more important things being done back home.
Anyone else?
Just to say, sometimes noisy toddlers are really good for getting attention. People won't focus on the process of getting there and the enormous amount of global engagement there's been, but they will focus on the outcomes of the conference, and that's good for media representation. Sorry, is that better? I'm just saying, really.
The microphones are very unidirectional. So
very unidirectional.
You lose it.
Okay. All I was saying is sometimes being a noisy toddler is really good for getting attention. It may not be that, you know, so that may be the really good way of being able to focus the world's eyes on a particular issue at a particular time.
Just also to add that knowing, for people to know that we are working with other countries and we are working collaboratively, we do know is, again, part of that bedrock. It isn't a direct motivation, but it's something that they expect to be happening. So it does have a role there. It's also prompted, I would say, both DEC and ourselves to look at how we engage with people to communicate what government is actually doing in policy terms, because that's clearly a big challenge to actually be able to communicate it. But there is some appetite in how we actually manage to do that. And it's also, I think, prompted an interest in those people that will actually be mobilised to, not necessarily by government, but by the Green groups or by other organisations, to act and to campaign for Copenhagen to be successful. So I think in that sense, it's got benefits in terms of thinking about engaging with people differently, as well as how you communicate what's actually happening in the run-up and thereafter. So we certainly don't see it, as we said, as a noisy toddler in that way, but it's given a focus to a particular strand of work that will hopefully carry on.
It matters, but it absolutely doesn't let us off the hook on the other things we have to do. Claudia, I'm not sure I can read this correctly, Kus Tenzer from Waste Watch. Yes.
Thank you. Well, what struck me was that resolve obviously has a V in it, which stands for values, but I feel we haven't really talked about values today very much. It has come up in some of the presentations, but not as a very explicit point of discussion. So if I remember my question correctly, it was whether the members of the panel believe that the scale of behaviour change that we need can only be achieved with the change of values. And if so, how do we achieve this change of values, and what are these values, and who decides what they are, and what are the processes to decide them? Sorry, that was several questions in one.
You remembered very accurately. I'm going to ask Madeline to start on this, because I think she did really get us quite a lot into values.
Yeah, I'm confused, really, because I think there's been a lot of discussion about values. So I feel that I'm at the risk of repeating myself, really. I'm trying to think of another way into it, because you clearly didn't recognise it as values. But, you know, it seems to me, you know, issues like less is more and renunciation, sacrifice, this is all about values. And, you know, just to sort of expand it, if you're sacrificing the idea of foreign holidays, which was not a common habit in the 1950s. I mean, that may be one aspect that we lose, a kind of pattern of tourism and mobility is one of the things we sacrifice. And we could argue that you could apply a kind of seductive narrative to that by saying that there are ways of conviviality, of pleasure, of enjoyment, of leisure, which are all possible within your locality, that can also generate at the same time many other benefits in terms of a stronger sense of community, lower crime, greater sense of security. So I think actually values underlies almost everything this panel has been talking about. I hope perhaps that helps kind of draw it out.
Nick.
Yes, thank you. It's a good question, and it's one that's, again, Tim and the Resolve team probably have a lot more to say about than I do. But I'll just make one point. You're right, yes, values have to change. I don't think there's any doubt about that. In the technical literature, there's a distinction which is very important between upstream interventions and downstream interventions. Downstream being that people are doing some behavior and have a set of values, and then you attempt to change them in some way through some communication. Now, upstream, you try to get to them before a value is formed, if they're young, or in some other way. So a good example would be if the seatbelt campaign was resisted for a long, 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 long time by many parties, and it was very difficult just to communicate to people that they should wear seatbelts. So you had to bring an upstream intervention with the communication, which was obviously legislation. And then over a period of time, you then get a change of values around the issue, and now most people are very happy to do that. So I think somebody else has said here at the conference that many of the situations are different in their manifestation. So an intervention campaign which has upstream and downstream elements has to be sensitive to the particulars of the particular issue and behaviour you're trying to change.
Great. I'm delighted to welcome Angela Eagle to this event. I know that the Minister has to be somewhere else fairly quickly, and so I'm going to ask her now to address the audience. The last time we saw each other, yes, please have the lectern if you'd like to. We were at a Sustainable Development Minister's session on climate change adaptation, and I think you remarked quite pointedly that you were supposed to be doing 30 amendments on the finance bill, so where were some of the other ministers who ought to be listening to this stuff? So the floor is yours. We'll come back to debate after we've heard you speak. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, and thank you particularly for interrupting what was obviously a good and important session in order to fit me in. It's a great pleasure to be here. When I originally accepted this speaking engagement, it was when I was Exchequer Secretary to the Treasury. I ceased to be Exchequer Secretary to the Treasury with the responsibility, amongst other things, for taxation policy in the area of climate change and sustainability about a week ago, and became Minister for Pensions and the Ageing Society. And obviously in the interim, I've had a bit of time to contemplate the similarities between the two areas. And actually there are, because pensions policy and ageing is about a long-term issue and a challenge, which is also an opportunity. You have to have an intergenerational agreement in order to make good, robust policy going forwards. And whilst you could have a panic and run around saying we're all doomed and it's going to be terrible, actually, we can work our way through this because human ingenuity always has, and it's always delivered us good solutions. So I think actually we're in similar areas of trying to get something that's socially sustainable if we're talking about pensions, and obviously that's environmentally sustainable if we're talking about the threats and opportunities that we have to face if we're going to prevent catastrophic climate change as we move towards the Copenhagen summit. I think also this is about re-engineering on what I call a brownfield site. You can't recreate new structures. You have to change and transform the ones you've got. You have to have a passage, a transformation process, which involves change from the structures you have now, be it the energy structures, be it the social and housing infrastructure we have, the infrastructure we have for energy efficiency in a commercial setting as well as a domestic setting. There are issues that we have to engage with, as all of you know, on a state-to-state level internationally with the agreements that we hope to come to at Copenhagen, and those are extremely complex and will involve a great deal of sophisticated diplomacy. At the same time, the government can enable companies and organisations to try to assist in the change that we need to achieve, and we also have to empower and inform, possibly inform and empower, possibly that way around, individuals to be able to make the changes to their own assumptions and lifestyles, which will lead us to the solution we need domestically as well as internationally. This means that we have to think in a much more holistic way about the effects of our policy making and the effects of how we live our lives, how we pay our way in the world, how we organise for that to be in the future. It also means, I think, that we have to be collaborative. We have to think about fairness, both within our societies, across the social spectrum, but also between countries, because we won't get an agreement at Copenhagen, and we won't deserve to, if we can't improve fairness, if we can't recognise that as the longest, most mature industrialised economies, a lot of the climate change that's already in the pipeline that is unstoppable as being caused by initial industrialisation, as well as recognising that we've got to assist economies like China in their legitimate aspirations to get their own populations out of poverty without doing the kind of damage to the climate that we did when we were industrialising. So it's about how we can move towards sustainable approaches there. It's about thinking, for example, how we can pull through the technology that we need to achieve our goals. I think that it's going to be pretty difficult to assume that all of the sulphurous coal deposits that there are in China aren't going to be used. Therefore, we've got to think about how we can bring on stream as quickly as possible the carbon capture and storage technology that we need to help them do that. It's far easier to try to have solutions than try to prevent people doing things, especially when they're in other countries who have a development need. So there's a whole range of issues around that, and we have to have cooperation and international collaboration to achieve it. In terms of what we can then do and what the role of the state is, I think it is in empowering and enabling technological pull-through in, for example, trying to ensure that the near-term technologies are brought along quickly, that we try to stimulate more research which the market might not provide in those other technologies that we think will be some of our answers, be it for transport, be it for heating, and all of those things. And I think that the government has a good record in trying to pump prime some of that. We have to work with our EU partners to ensure that we make the trading systems and mechanisms that are being set up to use market mechanisms as robust as possible. We then have to make sure that they're interoperable with other systems which may not have been developed yet, but which surely will be. What's happening in America, it's important that the EU trading system can speak to and interact with any other systems that may be set up. We've got to make certain, for example, that our carbon credit structures will then assist the development of much more sustainable solutions for those countries that are developing now, that we can think about how to finance carbon sinks or save the rainforests, the biodiversity that we're all so reliant on. So there's a range of issues. But I think that we've made a reasonable start. We've got a very, very difficult series of transformations to achieve. And we won't achieve that if we're not optimistic about being able to do that, and if we don't involve everybody by education, by empowerment, by assisting change, both at domestic, company, national, international level. And I think that the themes around all of that are cooperation, they are collaboration, they are optimism, I think, because the task ahead of us is so difficult. But I think that I agree with what Nick Stern said when he said there will be no economic growth that isn't sustainable in the future. You cannot and you will not have economic growth if it's done in an unsustainable way. The only real option for us going forwards is to ensure that we grow our economies in a sustainable way and we have a much more sophisticated way of measuring that sustainability. So those are just some of my initial observations. I'm happy to listen to comments or answer a few questions.
Great, thanks indeed. How long are you able to be with us?
15 more minutes.
Great, fantastic. So, because I'm sure people would like to ask a couple of questions, I'd like to ask one myself, actually, related to the discussion we've been having. Because it's got us into the territory of whether politicians are comfortable with talking to people about values and moral purpose in this whole issue of sustainable consumption, or whether they are reluctant to do so. And I wondered what your view was on that.
Well, I think, obviously, a lot of the choices that are made in politics more broadly about the kind of society that we want to create and what underpins it, by definition, have moral aspects. I think that we've got to talk about moral values such as fairness and collaboration and cooperation, such as our duties as a developed economy to those economies that are developing. Our duties, particularly in the redistributive implications of some of the work we have to do within our own social structures in this country as well as between countries. And I think there's a ways of doing that. I don't think we can preach. I don't think we should preach. I think we should try to engage in serious debate about some of these choices.
I'm sure there are questions from the audience, so I'm going to ask the lady here first.
We've done an awful lot today about talking about consumers and how to persuade them to be more sustainable. But as a consumer myself, it's very hard to make those efforts when there's nothing from the top in terms of joined up thinking that gives a reason for us to believe the government takes it seriously. Like, I stayed over at a hotel last night and they had little mini jars of jam and little mini things of soap. And I thought, well, we have health and safety executives that check out companies. Should we have a sustainability inspector? Because the hotels won't do things, or businesses won't do things that give them a competitive disadvantage. Stuff like that creates a level playing field and shows that it's being taken seriously from the top, which then legitimises the whole subject. So I was wondering, you know, is the government going to take any more serious actions, do you think?
I think we have taken serious actions to date. I think the Stern report itself, which made the intellectual and economic case for responding to this, was the first in the world that actually engaged with an economic department rather than an environmental department. That immediately, believe it or not, treasury departments tend to be more powerful than environmental departments in most governments. And I think that actually led the way in engaging governments at a higher, more powerful level with some of the discussions about why actually it's cheaper economically to have a more sustainable approach to the transformation that's before us, rather than hive it off into an environmental department. And that needs to be mainstreamed across all departments. Do I think we need a sustainability inspector to tell hotels that they can't have little pots of jam? Or probably not. I mean, I hope that what we need to do is get the main sort of pathways from where we are now to where we need to go in place. And I think we've begun to do that. We've got, for example, the Climate Change Act now, which mandates future governments in this country to reach our carbon targets, reduction targets, over the next 50, 60 years. We have carbon budgets which sit along the actual financial budget alongside that, so that there's actual planning that's open and above board about how we can get from where we are now to where we need to be in a timely fashion. And those budgets, those carbon budgets, have to be met. I think we've also got a range of other things that flow from that. So I think it's for governments to put the national structures in place and do the international heavy lifting with respect to agreements. And I think if we get that right, other things follow and other things flow from that. I think it would be wrong to turn it round and get the whole thing discredited by having a load of inspectors before we've got the main frameworks in place. I think that there's an increasing acknowledgement amongst businesses, hotels included, that they've got to start thinking differently about this. I think we probably need better analysis and measurement of sustainability so people can begin to understand it. We need to come to international agreements so that we can talk in and measure in the right way, in a way that's meaningful. And I think those are the most important things to put in place at the beginning.
Oh, wow, look at this, a lot of hands. I hadn't thought of our watchdog function in the SDC extending to pots of jam in government departments, but perhaps it should. Now, the lady in the front here, and gentleman third row back, I'm going to take you two first because you've been waiting, I think. Sorry, you wanted to follow up on that same point as well. Okay, you follow up on that point, and then the lady at the front and the gentleman in the third row.
Hello. I just want to say that I do think that there is a sort of failure of leadership in the government, and that the sort of much vaunted moral authority of the government seems to rest on plans for the future, reports and analysis, and not on actions now. And I think the government needs to take some high-profile actions to convince the population that climate change is a serious problem. They could start off by ruling against the third runway at Heathrow, for instance. If the government did that, the ordinary person in the street might say, hey, crikey, the government have just said we can't have a third runway at Heathrow. Climate change must be a pretty serious issue, or they wouldn't have done that. And maybe that might even make some people reconsider their foreign holidays, etc. And the government, in my view, is missing some really simple opportunities to show some authority. I was tremendously disappointed with the car scrappage scheme. It seems to me that you can get the £2,000 regardless of what kind of car you're buying. The government could have said you only get the £2,000 if it's below a certain engine capacity. That would have been a total win. You know, what would have been wrong with that as a scheme? And it would have sent a powerful message to the public.
Okay.
Can you say where you're from? It would help.
Yes,
me.
Could you identify yourself?
What people's names were, that's
yes.
Also helpful. If
Thank
I know
you.
Where you're from, that's also yeah. Useful.
Okay, my name is Simon Allen. I'm a citizen of the world. I do not have any other affiliation, and I'm not speaking for any organisation. I'm speaking from myself,
okay.
Or myself.
So high-profile actions. Okay.
My name is Lorna Arblaster, and I'm a UK taxpayer. In view of the fact that myself and many other UK taxpayers are putting a lot of money into supporting the banks, isn't it time that the UK government was less timid and taking a more proactive approach to what it is the banks will lend money for, and that banks like, well, various of our banks shouldn't be lending money to extractive industries and to industries such as the tar sands oil extraction?
Okay, I'm just going to ask one more question and give the Minister time to pause for thought here.
Thank you, Mr. My name is Sadiq Janka. I work for an energy environment consultancy called KMG Econometrics. Can I ask the Minister to comment on one aspect which has not been discussed, given my background, the use of economic instruments to encourage behaviour change and lifestyle change? Clearly, economic instruments are not sufficient on their own, but I suspect that some of the attempts to encourage lifestyle changes may not work on their own. And secondly, there is, of course, the imperative of the fiscal position. There's a big hole in the fiscal position, and it'll have to be rectified whichever government comes into power. Clearly, there is a role for taxes. So, in other words, why can't we have a shift in the tax burden towards green taxes, which then also give a stimulus to some of the behaviour changes we've been discussing in the conference here today?
Okay.
Right, Simon, I mean, in terms of approaches to particular issues like Heathrow, the result on the third runway at Heathrow is controversial. It's been designed and done out of the Department of Transport using recognised analysis. It's always possible to make anything a symbolic policy. But I think the important thing going forwards is to remember that we have to re-engineer our economy. And that doesn't mean to say that in future there'll be no airline traffic. So we have to modernise our infrastructures as well as changing. So it's not either or. And it's possible for some of these things to coexist, even if you personally disagree with the Heathrow decision. Some of the way forwards on that it is about redesigning aircraft, making them less polluting, less damaging, seeing what we can do technologically to stimulate a new generation of cleaner, greener transport, be they aircraft or other forms of transport. And we've got to try to do that. I think the existence of the Climate Change Committee, which looks at a range of these things, can publish reports about it from an expert point of view will stimulate a lot of debate about this. We've got to do technical things like look at discount rates and how we make these decisions in the future, how we price in climate and carbon and that kind of shift. And I think we're just at the beginning of some of the technical information there. Now, you could just be symbolic and take symbolic actions all the time, but I think also you have to take the public with you. And I think this effort to re-engineer the way that we do things in our world, the way that we run our economies, won't take people with it if it's seen as just a way of stopping people doing what they now can do. We've got to try to have a more sophisticated discourse with people about how we can transform the way we run our societies, but not take away people's rights to foreign holidays or whatever. We've got to think about how we can make those less burdensome in terms of climate change. Otherwise, people will just not want to listen and they won't want to get involved in making the switch that we need to make. So we've got to take people with us. I think that's something to say. In terms of car scrappage, the car scrappage scheme wasn't to make or meet green outcomes. It was a short-term, one-year response to the worst circumstances that one of our major manufacturing industries has had in 50, 60 years. And it wasn't sold in terms of having anything other than a very minor positive effect in terms of carbon emissions from cars. We have quite a good story to tell because of the regulatory decisions that have been taken in the EU and because of the technological change that's already been driven in car engines on that issue. We've changed and reshaped the way that we raise vehicle excise duty to take account of emissions. We've begun to change structures there to try to give signals to people. We've got the new car labelling schemes. And so there's a range of other policy in place there which is doing that job. And not everything that government should do at this moment ought all to be about that one issue. You have to balance these things, in my view. Laura, in terms of banks lending money, I don't think that the government can easily get into telling commercial organisations, albeit some of them currently supported by state support following the credit crunch, what or who or why they can lend money. But there are issues about planning and major infrastructure developments. If something's very, very ungreen, be it tar sands or anything else, extractive industries, then there are things that government can do in order to try to improve recycling. And we do that with things like instruments like the landfill tax, like the aggregates tax, which have led to positive results in terms of the use of recycled aggregates and all of those things. So there is progress in those areas. And I think increasingly banks and businesses are coming to see, although there's still more evangelising to do, that there are benefits for them in being greener in the way in which they do things. And I expect that to carry on changing, and I expect this, the scale of that change to become more rapid as we go on. In terms of the issue with economic instruments, I think that the Stern analysis showed that there's a range of responses that you have to make. And economic instruments are certainly important. The market can assist in making some of these transformations. If we can put a price on carbon, if we can have a robust price, if we can essentially create a market in carbon and police it in a way that's actually stable and not too volatile, then we can ensure that a lot of the infrastructure investments we need going forward can actually be properly priced and paid for. And it also gives us a tax instrument that we can then use to support a shift from older, polluting, unsustainable solutions to more sustainable solutions, and also to support green development mechanisms, clean development mechanisms, and development in countries that aren't as developed as we are, as well as saving some of the world's lungs, if we want to put it that way, by protecting rainforests and biodiversity. And I think that we are beginning to develop instruments like that. I think also, obviously, though, we have to regulate in some cases and we have to make illegal in others. And that's a range of different options to solve the problems that are before you. If we think about CFCs, for example, and we didn't want to put a price on CFCs or have a market mechanism. We just acted to abolish them because they were so destructive of the ozone layer, and that was a successful piece of work that was done. So I think you have to look at what the issue is and see what the most appropriate response is. What we know is that there's a basket of possibilities ranging from international agreements to ban to regulatory tightening over time, to giving credit to have technological pull-through and taxes. And we've got to do a range of all of those.
Thank you very much. Do you have time for one more question, or do you need to go?
One more, but then I must dash. Fine. To get very, my very green train.
Quick question. Excellent. Right, gentleman over here, and it needs to be snappy, please. Say who you are.
My name is Mark Dowd. I work with a small NGO called Operation NOAA, which works a lot with churches and schools. My question is this. It's about defence and security in climate change. Margaret Beckett made a very important speech about this in 2005 at the UN, saying this is one of the most pressing issues in the next decades. We have £33 billion in a defence budget and £500 million going into R&D and renewables for the Energy Technologies Institute. If Sir David King said that this is a bigger threat than international terrorism, isn't it time that we engage with a really serious debate about where our money is going? I don't think tanks and replacements for Trident buy me much security compared with climate change.
Right. Thanks.
Well, I mean, as always, you have to get a balance with these things, and sometimes I actually... You have to get a balance. I mean, I think that if you seriously said that we should dismantle the defence budget completely, then most of the electorate in the UK would not agree with that approach. So I think that what we've got to do is have a debate about priorities and make those shifts which we need. But actually sometimes our armed services are the ones that actually assist us in helping. Not all the use of the armed services is for reasons of war. I mean, our armed services often will go in and help when there are emergencies due to climate effects, earthquakes, instability in places. So we have to get a right balance between the capacities that we have for our own defence and to be able to project organisation and support abroad. Now, I'm not talking about war there. I'm talking about other more benign peacekeeping uses of the armed services. So I think we need a more sophisticated debate than we've had about that. Everybody's entitled to their views on Trident, and I'm sure we're going to have increasing debates about that as we confront some of the choices and constraints that the credit crunch have left us with.
Right. Could I...
Well, one person agreed, anyway.
Could I thank the Minister? Whatever you think of some of the issues, she has come straight into a conference, straight up on the podium, didn't take the whole time speaking, and actually really took questions from the floor. So a hand of applause for that, please. And thank you for joining us. As well as having to be Minister for just about everything in government, which...